Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. In 2000, computer scientist Bill Joy wrote an article for Wired on the apocalyptic threats posed by robotics, artificial intelligence, genetic engineering, and nanotechnology. The thesis of the article was that humans were rushing to develop technologies which could escape our control and destroy human life. The article was a strong endorsement of some green Luddite warnings, made all the more resonant since they were coming from the lead scientist for Sun Microsystems and co-developer of the Java computer language. Their argument is that even if the risk for human annihilation from these technologies is very small, they should still be banned or voluntarily relinquished. What Joy and the Luddites have not included in their risk calculations is the risks of human beings remaining at our current level of technology indefinitely. Although humans have proved a pretty serious threat to the non-human part of our planet, the non-human parts of the universe are still a pretty big threat to us. From plagues and earthquakes to asteroids and gamma-ray blasts, human existence is a precarious one. Looking out at the universe, we are confronted with Fermi's challenge. Given the enormity and age of the galaxy, why are we the only visible, intelligent life? It may be because the threats to life are more numerous than we have estimated, and our need to prepare for those threats using new technologies more pressing than we have imagined. This is the great virtue of Doug Mulhall's book, Our Molecular Future, How Nanotechnology, Robotics, Genetics, and Artificial Intelligence Will Transform Our World. Mulhall's is the first nonfiction work to examine in depth how we might use nanotechnology to protect against natural disruptions such as hurricane, earthquake, and flood. Mulhall has written widely on environmental and natural risk issues, coming from a background co-designing, building, and operating the first water recycling and flood control facilities in Brazil and China that used integrated agriculture to meet international standards. Mulhall co-founded O Instituto Ambiental, the first Brazilian NGO devoted to wastewater recycling. He concurrently serves as managing director of the Hamburg Environmental Institute, supervising international sustainability projects. He also developed novel environmental assessment technologies and produced environmental documentaries in the former Soviet republics. Welcome, Mr. Mulhall.
Thanks very much. It's nice to be here.
As I said in my introduction, one of the great virtues of your work is that you are promoting nanoecology, which is a very useful integration to my mind of green concerns with technological projection. And it really overcomes some pastoral Luddite tendencies on the part of green politics and also is chastening on the technology side. So I assume that it's sometimes a difficult conversation on both of those spheres when you get with a crowd of ecologists and with a crowd of technologists.
Well, actually, one of the challenges that we face today is bringing the crowd of technologists and the crowd of ecologists together in a forum that lets us understand what these technologies really mean for us ecologically. And that is one of the important sub-themes of the book. One of the great challenges that science is presenting with us, especially due to the discoveries of the last 10 years, is that we are about to experience a herd of elephants running through the room of environmentalism. And that herd is really going to take three forms. And I just want to emphasize again that these disruptions to conventional environmental theory are being driven by scientific discovery rather than political dogma. And if I may, I'll just take a moment to explain what these three great waves are that are currently beginning to disrupt conventional environmental theory.
Please do.
The first aspect is the discovery that extreme environmental phenomena are not all that unusual in our history. For example, due to investigations into sediment samples and tree ring samples over the last several thousand years, we have recently discovered that there were very severe disruptions to the world climate in the 5th and 6th centuries due to an as-of-yet unconfirmed event, which may have been anything from an asteroid strike to a very large volcanic eruption, that resulted in the ejection of very substantial amounts of dust into the atmosphere. And these have been found in sediment samples all around the world in layers similar, although not identical, to the iridium layer that was found 65 million years ago from the asteroid that that we now know led to the extinction of the dinosaurs. But this was a lesser event that nonetheless led to an extreme disruption of world temperatures. And the result of that was that we saw tremendous disruption to agricultural patterns around the world that may have indeed led to a lot of the very substantial disruptions to civilizations that we saw around that period, the emergence of the Black Death in areas that the plague was previously not known for, and a whole other raft of ecological changes that have been noted around the world in ancient literatures. So it's not only in the deep past that we have experienced these serious environmental disruptions, but as our science becomes more sophisticated at determining what has happened in our past, we are finding that actually we are at risk from naturally occurring disruptions that could not have possibly been caused by humans. That is not to downplay the potential risk that humans may pose to the environment, and I want to emphasize that because we don't want to give an excuse to people who say, well, it's quite all right to go ahead and make a mess of the environment because actually nature's going to do it anyways. That's not the point. The point is to say that we may be just as much or more at risk from nature as from ourselves, and that we haven't paid sufficient attention to that risk. Another example is scientist by the name of Richard Alley wrote a book a few years ago called Two-Mile Time Machine. And what he did through over a period of 10 years is he went up to Greenland and drilled a 2-mile deep ice core in the ice in Greenland and found that this was a very good record of climate changes over the years. And one of the things that he discovered was that up until about 10,000 years ago, climate variations were actually extremely severe and much more so than they were today. And this led to the conclusion that actually we have been living in these years when our technologies and our agriculture has developed in a relatively calm period, but that calm period is by no means guaranteed to continue. So the conclusion that arises from these new scientific discoveries is that we are at risk from these natural factors. And this is what I call the first elephant in the room of environmentalism, because conventional environmental theory basically says our climate is essentially stable and we are the ones that pose the most severe threat to it. There is merit to that argument, but there is also a merit to the argument that says that nature also creates enormous changes to the climate, and as such, we must be prepared to adapt to those changes. The next elephant in the room is, again, due to scientific discovery that indicates that the Earth, in fact, is not a closed ecosystem. The conventional wisdom is that the Earth sits in space by itself, relatively unaffected by everything outside of its own biosphere, and as such, is a closed system with very little going into and out of it except, of course, energy from the sun. Well, actually, we're discovering that that is not true. And I'll just give you some examples, the most significant of which occurred in 1994 when the Shoemaker-Levy 9 comet hit Jupiter. We've discovered recently, for example, that literally millions of tons of matter enter Earth's atmosphere in the form of micrometeorites that are striking the Earth every second. Additional to that, it has recently been discovered that the magnetosphere of Earth occasionally flips, and when it does this, the solar wind, which is composed of tiny radioactive particles, actually becomes much more intense and has the potential to seriously mutate living forms on Earth. So, and then, of course, we come to the patently obvious things that most people don't even think about anymore, and that is the gravitational influences of the moon that regularly moves trillions of tons of water around the planet every few hours to make the tides ebb and flow. So when you take these things put together, we are coming to the scientific understanding that Earth, in fact, is not a closed system, but in fact is open to the rest of the solar system and interacts with it. So this is a fundamental challenge to the conventional environmental wisdom that says we only have to take care of our own biosphere, and if we take care of that biosphere, then it will probably take care of itself. We're actually learning that's not the case, that there are many external influences that lead it to be a much more open and dynamic system. And that, again, leads us to the conclusion that we must learn to adapt to those extremes as we confront them, because simply leaving the Earth to take care of itself may not be enough to protect us.
In other words, protecting our biosphere may require some gargantuan engineering projects on the part of humanity in the future. We can't just benignly sit back and try to remove our influence from nature. We actually have to take a proactive role to defend the planet.
Well, there are actually two possibilities that we face in that area. One is what I call the 10 trillion ton gorilla approach, which is basically what you said, is massive terraforming and changing the biosphere in ways that we think might make it possible to improve our situation. There are, of course, many, many detractors with many legitimate arguments against that approach. And on the other hand, our molecular scale technologies are presenting with us with another fascinating possibility. And that possibility is to develop the ultimately adaptable human that in fact lives lightly on the Earth and does not need to engage in these massive terraforming projects, because we as individuals will be able to adapt in very flexible ways to anything that nature throws at us. Now, the issue, one of the issues that we're going to have to deal with that the environmental community has not even begun to approach yet, is which of those approaches or the compromise amongst those approaches is going to work best for us. And an example would be, obviously, if you discover that an asteroid is coming in at the planet and is going to cause considerable chaos if it hits, right now we have no defenses against that, and every environmentalist who knows anything about this will tell you that we certainly have no defenses and we are at risk. There is no argument about that. The conventional weapons options that have been presented, and this was dealt with as far back as 1983 by Carl Sagan in his book Pale Blue Dot, are to throw up these nuclear weapons and supposedly, you know, blast these things out of our orbit or blast them into tiny little pieces. But there are huge risks associated with that, the biggest of which is that anyone that can blast an asteroid out of our orbit also has the power to direct an asteroid into our orbit, bringing you the ultimate form of planetary terrorism. So there are big risks associated to these conventional big science solutions to these types of threats. Molecular scale technologies may give us a far more elegant solution by allowing us to actually consume these asteroids and convert them into useful materials that we can then develop space-based factories out of, and we'll get into that as we get further into the discussion. But the point being that we still have these options. One is the 10 trillion ton gorilla approach, and the other is living lightly on the Earth approach that is a much more fine and detailed and individually adaptive approach. And those are the types of discussions that we need to have in order to determine how we might use these very powerful new technologies.
Well, let me take a step back. First, let me reintroduce us. This is Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and I'm speaking today with Doug Muhlhall, who's the author of Our Molecular Future, How Nanotechnology, Robotics, Genetics, and Artificial Intelligence Will Transform Our World. And you've actually turned genetic engineering, robotics, artificial intelligence, and nanotechnology into an acronym of GRAIN, calling them GRAIN technologies. Now, since you're talking about molecular-level technologies, is your projection that these technologies will converge at the molecular level? I mean, genetic engineering and nanotechnology are obviously already genetic technologies, and we are talking in the future about nanorobotics. Is it necessary, for instance, that we have advances in artificial intelligence in order to have molecular technology?
Well, first of all, I'd like to emphasize that one of the fundamental aims of the book is not to project a certain future, but rather to project potential futures that we face in a way that everybody who wants to understand where our technologies might be taking us is able to understand. So I just want to emphasize that I have...
You're not a determinist.
I'm not a determinist because we face many potential futures based on the choices that we're going to make. We can just as well become a super race with unimaginable capabilities as we can be disrupted by natural influences that could throw us back to the Dark Ages. And the way that we approach our technologies will determine to a great degree which pathway we take. And the purpose of the book is not so much to say this is the way we're going, but rather to say we have to start asking the right questions. And a lot of those questions are in the book. So with that preamble, I'll reply to your question by saying that you're absolutely right. It is the convergence of these grain technologies, genetics, robotics, artificial intelligence, and nanotechnology, rather than any individual technology, that is leading us into these tremendous possibilities that we have. And I can give you a concrete example that exists today, and it is known as desktop manufacturing. And it's relatively easily explained just describing what everyone has in their home today, or most people have in their home today, and that's a bubble jet printer. Even 10 years ago, most people didn't have, they either had a dot matrix printer or a very primitive type of printer, or they went to the print shop and got things done with a photocopier. And today, of course, that revolution has taken over because bubble jet printing has allowed us to print the most sophisticated types of documents at home. Now, if you take a bubble jet printer and you replace the ink with plastic, one of the things that a lot of companies have now been able to do is to print in three dimensions. And an example of that would be surgeons in your area, in Massachusetts, for example, have started to use scans from CAT scans or MRI machines of patients to do three-dimensional digitalized images of their patient's bone structure, take that digitalized information and feed it into a processor that then instructs a bubble jet printer that uses plastic instead of ink to print wafer-like layers of these human anatomies so that you can actually print, for example, a human skull. So if a physician is going to do surgery, brain surgery, or they're going to do cosmetic surgery on the bone structure of the skull, they will use this MRI to digitalize the image and then print a three-dimensional, precise, personalized model of the patient so that they no longer have to do exploratory surgery in order to figure out exactly what it is that they're going to do with that patient. This is a real revolutionary development in surgery, and the interesting thing about it is it's fast and it's cheap. These machines cost anywhere from $75,000 to about $300,000, which in medical terms is very, very cheap. And it's not only limited to the medical profession. The car companies are now starting to manufacture small car parts with three-dimensional desktop manufacturing, and a number of other industries are using this. Now, this type of technology is only possible due to the convergence of these technologies, because you have computing combined with nanoscale technologies that allow very precise manipulation of the printer head to produce an exact replica based on digital information. And so that is a concrete example of how convergence of these technologies is really allowing us to do things that we never even dreamed were possible. And most importantly, it is reducing the cost of doing things. We've been able to do a lot of these things for many years. The military has been able to do many things that are not on the market today, but at enormous cost. The point is, we can now democratize these things by making them very, very cheap.
Give me a concrete example about how these technologies would help us prepare for, say, for instance, an earthquake or for global warming, how they would help us remediate the effects of these and prepare for the effects of these.
Right, and also how quickly that is happening. A concrete example of that is something called carbon nanotubes, which I think many of the university students who are listening to this broadcast who are involved in the nanoscale sciences might be familiar with, but I'll just take a minute to roughly explain it. Carbon nanotubes are basically nanoscale strings of carbon-based structures that have some very special properties associated with them. They can conduct electricity with enormous ease, almost as easily as superconducting materials can. And at the same time, they are extremely flexible, and they are extremely strong. And if they are doped with just a trace elements of other materials, for example, they can be up to 30 times stronger than steel, and at the same time can conduct electric current, and at the same time can conduct computing. So this revolutionary discovery that was actually brought through by Richard Smalley at Rice University in Texas many years ago, and his team actually won the Nobel Prize for the discovery of what is called Bucky tubes and Bucky balls, named after Buckminster Fuller, have these materials have these very special properties. Now, the interesting thing is that even Dr. Smalley, up until very recently, was saying, well, you know, it's going to be a long time before this stuff is ever commercially feasible because it's so difficult to produce these very small nano-sized things that, you know, we probably are many, many years away from being able to use them for any commercial purposes. Well, lo and behold, not only the company that Dr. Smalley has spun off from his academic work, but also Mitsui in Japan, are in the process of building factories that are going to be producing tens of tons of these nanotubes. Now, what is the significance of this? What it means is that we, in the very near future, may be able to construct skins of buildings or to reinforce existing steel structures in buildings that make them virtually earthquake-proof, even for the most strong of earthquakes, and the key thing being at very low cost. So here we have a material that may be able to conduct an electric current, act as a sheet, a paint-on sheet of solar cells that provides energy to a building, and at the same time provides enormous structural strength that will not only make it resistant to earthquakes, but resilient against them, that is, with increased flexibility to allow buildings to move around without being destroyed. And this also applies, for example, to the 13 million people in Florida who are severely at risk once a year from hurricanes. And we just need to look back to Hurricane Andrew, or to look at what happens in the Midwest with tornadoes, or the 1994 Northridge earthquake, or what happened at Kobe, to understand that we are still very much at risk from these natural phenomena. And carbon nanotubes really provide us, for the first time in our history, with an affordable alternative to spending huge amounts of money on resistance against these extreme environmental phenomena.
This is Chen Shifu Radio. I'm Dr. J, and we're talking with Doug Muhlhall. He's the author of Our Molecular Future. Now, Doug, talking about the structural integrity of buildings and their resilience to earthquakes and floods, I'm sure you're aware that the given the same Richter scale earthquake event in the industrialized world versus the third world, many more people die in the third world, and the reason is because they're too poor to afford any of the advanced building materials that we use in the West, which are much more earthquake resistant, and also they have poorer public health systems, so that the disaster response mechanisms fail in the third world in ways they don't in the first world. So don't these technologies simply ramp up that question of the inequitable distribution of resources and technological advance around the world, so that, yes, a certain percentage, San Francisco may benefit from this, but Mexico City won't?
Right, and the extension of the digital divide. And the reply to that is, there is a tribe of native Indians in Guatemala who are still largely illiterate, who have been manufacturing furniture that used to be sold at a pittance to wholesalers, who then resold it in a network to markets in the United States. And yet today, in the last few years, this illiterate tribe, who have never been outside of their own area, are using cell phones to directly sell to clients in the United States. Now, this is an example of empowering technology. You see communications technology that has become so cheap that even the poorest, supposedly most primitive of individuals can exploit it to their own advantage. And I might add that most studies that have been done have shown that people who come from supposedly backwards areas of the world are just as, if not more, capable than highly educated individuals to adapt to new technology. So it is not a barrier if you make it useful. And the fact that these individuals that I mentioned in Guatemala are actually doing this is really the living proof that you can make these technologies affordable and useful for individuals. So how would that apply, for example, to the types of earthquake and storm resistance that that you're talking about? Well, the beauty of nanoscale technologies, if we develop them in the right way, is that they are going to make things extremely cheap. Solar cells, for example, which now one of the key difficulties with solar cells is not only are they expensive in terms of the cost of producing them and the cost of accessing the raw materials to produce them and all of the manufacturing costs, but they are also expensive in what is known as their energy payback, because it takes so much energy to actually manufacture them that they have to generate a lot of energy for the first few years before they pay back the energy that it took to manufacture them. Well, nanoscale technologies and desktop manufacturing that I just mentioned earlier are going to hopefully let us overcome those barriers, because the solar cells will, number one, be manufactured locally from locally available materials in a desktop machine. And secondly, we will be able to paint them onto surfaces so that they don't even have to be very efficient, because the tremendous breadth of the surface itself will allow very cheap conductivity of electricity from a very large surface such as a house or a road or something like that. And when you combine that with carbon nanotubes that can perform many functions at once, including structural stability, we see that the cost of doing these things will be greatly reduced. And for that reason, we may see societies leapfrogging from mid-20th century technologies to mid-21st century technologies without going through the middle path. And for that reason, I believe that we have the potential, if not the absolute possibility, but at least the potential to eliminate that digital divide. Now, that is not going to, that's not to say that highly technological areas won't run ahead of these other areas, but it is to say that we have the potential to make these benefits broadly available to less developed areas of the world. And I think that as I mentioned, there are already case examples of that happening.
This has been the first half of an interview with Doug Mulhall, author of Our Molecular Future. Check back next week for the second half of the interview, or listen to it at changesurfer.com in streaming MP3. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3, thanks to the A-Infos Radio Project. Also, at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.